Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Okay, another podcast while walking. I'll just try to keep the sound down and all that type of stuff. I'm going to do the periodic table. I've just had perhaps the most disastrous brain training I've ever done. I've did really poorly. The walker failed, and then I've got back into a brain training program, which I don't like the aspect of it, and I just can't get to it. And the system's super unresponsive, and I just feel pretty crap. But I did a podcast earlier on about trying to actually scope out a children's story to do with what I call Einstein Zero. This is the Einstein that everyone misses, or the Einstein that he automatically assumed you knew. Did he? I don't know. In terms of that, the fact that any distance from you is into the past. It's sort of a pretty spooky, amazing, sort of nice view. But what I'm going to do at the moment is do the periodic table, yes, once again, as I walk home after midnight, a broken person trying to do it. And, of course, this is just to sort things out. Let's get my brain into order. So it's hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminium, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon, potassium, calcium, scandium, vanadium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc, gallium, germanium, arsenic, selenium, bromine, krypton, rubidium, strontium, yttrium, zirconium, niobium, molybdenum, technetium, ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, silver, cadmium, indium, tin, antimony, tellurium, iodine, xenon, coming around again, cesium, barium, lutetium, cerium, promethium, praseodymium, neodymium, samarium, europium, goldium, terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, terbium, erbium, thulmium, thulmium, yttrium, lutetium, hafnium, tantalum, tungsten, rhenium, osmium, iridium, platinum, gold, osmium, platinum, gold, mercury, thallium, lead, bismuth, plutonium, astinium, radon, francium, radium, actinium, thorium, proactinium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium, americium, curium, Berkeley, californium, fermi, einsteinium, nobelium, mendeleev, nobelium, mendeleevium, nobelium, lawrencium, rutherfordium, dubnium, sigborium, borium, hafnium, yttrium, dinostratium, rotgonium, copernican, fluvium, nipponium, moscovium, livermorium, tennesseum, and organson. It seems to have gone through rather quickly. I'd have to actually see it. Now, for the you got your four blocks of the periodic table, the S sharp block, the P principal block, the D diffuse block, and the F the last block, F having a width of 2, 6, 10, 14 with them, and the elements with the an even atomic number are more abundant. I think that's it. And then the elements on the final row of each block are the least reactive. Well, or the I suppose it's a bit hard to describe it. The ones with so you get a trend across the periodic table with electronegativity. So electronegativity is a comparison table which goes from zero, as a comparison number, a unitless number, which is just used for calculations, you can't actually use it, and it goes from 0 to 3.99, whereas there's other properties like the whether they're paramagnetic or diamagnetic, ferromagnetic or antimagnetic. The only actually antimagnetic one is chromium. Chromium, which is an element. Bismuth is diamagnetic. The ones which have got a strong ferromagnetic is the iron, cobalt, nickel, and then the similar things in the F block. The electronegativity again goes up maximum around the chlorine, and electronegativity is the fundamental process of an atom to prefer to have the most stable form of an atom is with one extra electron. So the most stable form of an atom is an ion. So the most stable form of an atom is the negative ion. So chlorine is the most stable, and this is why the fact that an ion is the most stable form, a negative ion is the most stable form of an atom, gives you the electron affinity. But it gives you the fundamental reason for chemistry. For some reason, people can't seem to say this fundamental fact. It's really rather interesting that you've got these fundamental facts out there, and we get them wrong. We get them wrong about the most stable form of an atom is the number of neutrons, number of protons, whatever it is, giving you the atomic number of it, but it's one extra electron. There's a few exceptions where one less electron is more stable. There's actually so you can see me walking home at night, going through this godforsaken place, and it's pretty awful. It's been super hot weather. I've taken the pool cover off. I've got to get in and fix the pool, but it's now, after being thousands of degrees, it's really hot. I think it's just enough to get on top of the fires. Perhaps it's a godsend thing. So it's really interesting. These aspects for me as an educator, that the fundamental law of chemistry is missing, that atoms prefer to have one extra electron, and also the fundamental way to understand cosmology is missing, the fact that you go further away, if you move away, things drift back into the past. So if I send someone walking away from me, they will actually walk several kilometers away, and they will walk, as far as I can see, backwards in time, effectively backwards in time. And to try and get through there. I will have to actually get back and look at the, now I'm getting on top of it, the test of physics. Although, this really strange thing is that I'm doing a lot worse on my brain training. Like, before I used to absolutely smash my way through navigation exercises and stuff like that. I just my brain has just really gone flaky at this stage. So this is, I think, really, really interesting in that the angle into everything is through quantum mechanics and through special relativity. You get those two things together, and then you get these sort of real deeper mysteries like spin. You know, what is spin, and particles. The interesting thing is that people, I don't know, they get products and it's got full specification sheets, and they don't realize that the specification sheets become even flakier as you get down. So essentially, when you've got an object, you should be able to say how much it weighs, blah blah blah, its size, its dimensions, its color, and stuff like that. As you get down and down, smaller and smaller, you actually can't actually your sheet, data sheet, doesn't allow you to do certain things. So an electron has no parts. There is no part of an electron. There is no way to affix or identify a part of an electron. So if you spin it, you can see that you've rotated it. It's just sort of like this bizarre thing. If you can't rotate an electron, you can't rev it up. And so it's got this fundamental angular momentum and mass. It's where it's got its mass, which is from its interaction with Higgs bosons, as we now know, and that has a fundamental property of angular momentum, but it has none of the features that, if it's got angular momentum, it doesn't infer that it has got a spatial distance, that it's actually, it's got a part to it that you can actually spin. So this is interesting that essentially, if we're used to the parts, therefore we look over to the column of the property of those parts, the motion of those parts, the angular momentum. But with the electron, what happens is that the thing that fades off first, as it gets really small, is not the actual property, but the actual components of it. And what it's actually saying is that this this angular momentum is a property of the universe itself. That is, that I can communicate, or I can tell anywhere that I'm in my universe, that my rotation is with respect to the rest of the universe. This is this most fundamental aspect of it. And that it's then very fitting that these actual particles go down, which are actually made out of the universe. I mean, this is, you know, what is something it's made out of? It's actually made out of borrowed space. So essentially, if I make something, if I as a human try and make something, it will, now the human race cannot actually put energy and create matter. At the moment, the best we can do is get some matter and get some energy out. But so far, and when we get the energy out, it's got this symmetry from it. But we can only make equal amounts of matter and antimatter and annihilates. But essentially, what that is that where you go through the brain and actually put energy into space. So, I mean, the energy stored or counted in space, knotted in space, is here. So if you can imagine an electron, you can unwind an electron by putting a positron with it. The two will annihilate each other and create energy. You're allowed allowed to do it. So when you actually think of it, if I'm looking back in time, if I look at a proton, electron, annihilates, annihilation. I have two bits of matter of two different symmetries. They come together. One's travelling forward and one's travelling technically backwards in time. That's another amazing aspect of our understanding of antimatter. That's travelling backwards in time. So the antimatter annihilates and produces energy. Now, the result in this two radiation waves. Now, if I had a perfect mirror, 100% mirror, or a phase conjugate mirror, I'd be able to take that light and time reverse that light in such a way that that intense electric field would interact in a very intense space and create a proton electron pair, so a positron electric pair, which it does anyway all the time, frothing through. So this stuff of universe is really thick and tangible, and it has particles in it, and those particles are made of universe. Yeah, that's the fundamental thing. I build an electron out of a bit of universe here. It has a fixed angular momentum with respect to every other electron in the universe because it is made of that universe. This is pretty amazing. So I could have a different electron from a different universe that would have a different... Those two different universes would have a relative angular momentum to each other. So this is a really fundamental thing. Now, rather than two different universes, it's two... The two universes are superimposed on each other to create lack of spinning, or our sensation of spinning relative to the lack of spinning. So if I pirouette around, there is no... That's one thing that relativity doesn't touch, and it doesn't go... So the spin is not relative. Spin is absolute. And so you can actually... Now, this is interesting. It's absolute, but in different in different contexts. I find this rather interesting in terms of whether if your angular momentum is such a fundamental property, does it change in gravitational field, or does its property change in gravitational field? So the speed of time, the process of time... And this is the amount of time for something to occur. It's pretty interesting in terms of if you look at the way that, you draw a wave function, you've got the time-dependent Schrödinger wave equation of an object. And essentially, there is a gravitational field term in that object. Now, it's... I just find that very interesting to contemplate that. Essentially, if I write the wave function of a excited state, and if I put it in an intense near black hole, that excited state will behave in such a way that time will look to be slower, which is sort of a very interesting thing about... what actually is there something which is not relative, and like you've got all general relativity, but there is a general absolute frame. There's not an absolute positional frame, however, there is an actual absolute velocity. Yeah, there is actually a zero velocity, so there's no position. But there is a zero velocity, and it obviously doesn't matter all that much. But if we look at the the cosmic microwave background, it's blue and red shifted. We have a net velocity with respect to our point in the Big Bang. So we have, it's hard to say, there's obviously an equal amount of matter travelling the opposite direction, conservation of momentum in the universe. But nonetheless, we are rushing in one direction towards time. We're seeing time run a little bit faster in one direction. If that makes sense, there's the cosmic microwave background. And this is, again, this is shut up. I just want to get home. I'm sick of teaching. Just shut up and just go across. If you actually go through the cosmic microwave background, the image that you see is processed by several methods. Firstly, it's so your cosmic microwave background is incredibly, is a very small difference. I think it's 2.73 to 2.73, several decimals places different. It's one part in 10,000. It's actually a very incredibly same thing. But then there's a first perturbation. There is a Doppler shift in the microwave background, and this is an intense fact. And this is when we teach the cosmic microwave background, we don't teach any of that. Why? Because the bastards who are setting the tests don't know about it. So we're teaching to the ignorance level of our existing cohort of teachers, and they have a way of bullying things and keeping them ignorant. If you go into the cosmic microwave background and start to look at the data analysis, the variation between one part of the universe and the other is absolutely intensely small. But then there is a pole, a direction of the universe, a direction in which we are heading. And I haven't really thought through what it means that one part of the universe is red shifted and the other part is blue shifted, but our relative clock, it's the important thing is that we are traveling a relatively strong speed with respect to the start of time, which is what we can see the cosmic microwave background. So you've got that Doppler shift, and so what they do is that they subtract that Doppler shift, and then once they subtract the Doppler shift, they then re-zero it and then produces that blue and red shift, that slight temperature variation, and then they do some geometric analysis on it to calculate the spatial ripple on it, to look at the actual crinkliness, the angular the angular variation from one point to the other point. So if I get a compass, compass with 10 degrees on it, and I compare any two points, if the two points are really close, they're pretty much the same, but if they're far apart, they're different, and there's this angular difference, and so you get that variation, the angular variation in the microwave background, and it was that that they compute all these things, things about it. Now, the interesting thing is that in all these aspects, be it the periodic table, be it chemistry, be it Einstein, we have stopped at a point of comfortable ignorance in teaching our kids, and the thing is that we've got no support. If someone says, look, I have something more complex to say, is really relevant, what happens is that the people they have a choice. I can question what I've been teaching for years, and I can say, oh God, I really have to pay my money back, the salaries I've got. I really have to question everything across. Or they could say, oh, this person, let's listen to this person. Why is this person saying this? And the reason that I would be saying it is because this is what it is. This is what the maths is. This, there's two aspects to it. There is this sort of scientific candor. And it's not this sort of an external view that, oh, I will be not tell a lie, not fudge data, tell things as they are scientifically, and that's because I want people to believe in me, or the sort of external thing that there's an idea that scientists behave like scientists because they want to, they have a feeling that if they were to lie, they would devalue everything, and, which is true in terms of their view of truth is, I suppose, a quality view of truth. They're looking at truth plus quality, and they're not saying what they're saying is true, but what is said needs a qualification with it, a measurement, a qualification. This is from that practice. So there's habitual science, which leads you there. But there's also another theme in that they have, they're fundamentally people who listen to nature, and they're not going to lead the witness. They're not going to ask leading questions. They're there to assist the human race with their interrogation, putting nature in the dock, and they're there not to get a conviction, not to produce anything, but to assist the human race's interrogation of nature. So there is a certain sense that they're like their professionalism. It's like a lawyer has at the end of the day is their first duty, really basically, is to the law and to justice, and to assist the judge making his statement. Now, you can, within that envelope, assist in such a way that more professionally than someone could do without that knowledge. So that's a sort of very similar thing to a scientist, in terms of a scientist is there, and at the end of the day, they want to be able to make a statement which will withstand the test of time, and it is a legitimate statement. There is a statement of what nature is saying, with the actual removal of leading the witness. And I think it's you search data, and therefore make the most reasonable conclusion from the evidence that you found, which is different from people who make the conclusion first and therefore selectively search for evidence for what they're looking for. So it's a way to go through it there. So just coming into it, I think there's obviously a gap between what teachers do, and teachers do their in the they're not searching for evidence, they're constructing a qualification. They're supposed to be at least arm's length process, but it's also obviously if you are sort of paying for it, is sort of a cross between an arm's length process and a race. There's a sort of a Melbourne Cup carnival feel where you get your starting positions and you pay for trainers, stuff like that, and at the end of the day there is an aspect of fairness of it, but there's many aspects as possible are removed for the fairness. So it's essentially you want it to be a fair race, but you can handicap people, you can give people inside barrier to go across, and the people there, the teachers are conducting a social exercise. It is a social exercise. There's relationships with people, there's power structures, there's a whole lot of complexity aside from the actual getting the information across. And at a particular point in time, that stops, and there is actually no process there to break through, unless you start with something so radical and so extreme that it simply just replaces and overrides it. Rewires it. It's sort of like a on the steppes of Mongolia, and you're the Mongols, and you have these fantastic horse rides, and there's great valiance there, and it's the person who's got the greatest. Now, obviously, people with a bit more money will buy a better steed, have a little more practice, a little bit of time, be a bit fed a bit better, and then people will race to the top. So you've got this process here. So there's an element of fairness, but there's also an element of preparing to ensure that your people win again. And it is a theatre sport, education. However, if you can imagine the Mongol steeps, and the thing, and suddenly a quad bike turns up, and you've got mechanization going through. And I think education is ripe for mechanization. So as war was ripe for with Guderian, the Achtung Panzer, he basically, if you talk about business process, I'm really rambling here, but I really want to get to capture the point of all this madness that I'm chasing all these areas of. I'm running forward but slipping back, and this is why I sort of want to talk about this, is because I've just come out of this cognitive training where I've just done shit. Now, part of the shit is that the actual machines go into a modern, a more advanced system, and start testing me, and they just simply it doesn't respond. If I touch a button, it goes back, and I've touched the button, and it says no, and it lights up the button I've just touched to say that's the button you should have touched. And of course, you're going, fuck, it's really. But you realise that whether it's a machine or whether it's yourself, your brain's going to reach a certain point, a certain equilibrium point, and you're going to go back. And then you go back and you think, well, what is the actual structure I'm up against? And it is this trying to get your quad bike up against your sort of your oil and your quad bike up against this insanely closed system. However, the fact that it is closed means that there's a whole heap of opportunities sitting underneath the surface where people have potential to add to it, to think of different ways to go forward. It's not just buying a quad bike. There's a whole lot of things which aren't happening or have problems associated with it from this sort of very focused view that I can actually outsmart science. It's essentially what it is. They actually believe that they are teaching something. It's not that they're teaching the wrong science, they're teaching better science than the real science. They have discovered an educational version of science which is bizarrely easy to teach. It doesn't help people very much, but it's really, really great. It's sort of like the junk food, the Coca Pops or Nutri-Grain of science. Okay, that's all I have to say. I'm going up to my house, and that's for you a real ramble.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.